We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us, and we're also happy to have back once again on the program David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he stops by, and we talk about money management. Now, here's the deal. He usually begins by making a few comments. Sometimes it's a topic that has to do with the economy. Sometimes it's a particular topic that has to do with investing strategies. And then if you have questions about that or anything else that has to do with investing in money management, give us a call and ask your question. I know Dave will do his best to see if he can give you an answer. So with that, we say good morning. Welcome back.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. And first, I'd like to take this opportunity to wish all of our listeners a very wonderful and safe Thanksgiving holiday season. All right. Approximately about 2 weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal Sunday, Steve Yoder, chief of the Wall Street Journal's San Francisco Bureau, along with his sons, wrote a wonderful article entitled Three Financial Terms Kids Need to Know. Those terms are, first of all, one, direct deposit, two, dollar cost averaging, and three, index mutual funds. Steve explains in the article that these three rather simple but elegant concepts actually form the basis of his own family's economic foundation. Now, I couldn't agree with Steve more. He's right on point, and the sooner our own kids and our own grandkids grasp the power of these three concepts, the sooner they will be on their way to a solid financial footing. Let's teach our kids that when they obtain their first real employment, maybe it's a summer job flipping hamburgers at the fast food restaurant, or maybe it's a full-time job, let's have the employer direct deposit the paycheck into our kids' checking account. That eliminates the immediate desire to spend it. In other words, of Steve Yoder, the biggest secret to saving money is not spending it. Pretend it isn't even there. I just think that's such great advice, especially for our kids and grandkids who are part of that now generation and want to spend every nickel. Next, after you direct deposit the checking into your checking account, open an investment account with a mutual fund company that offers low-cost index funds. Choose even one fund for your kid. Maybe choose two to invest in, such as an S&P 500 fund, or maybe it's a total market index fund. And here's the key. As part of the account setup, have the mutual fund company debit the checking account monthly in an appropriate amount so that each month a part of that paycheck is being invested automatically in the mutual fund. In other words, your kids or your grandkids, why, they don't even see that money. They don't have a chance to spend that money. Of course, what we are really accomplishing by instituting this investment strategy is simply known as dollar cost averaging. In other words, each month or pay period, we're automatically investing the same amount of dollars into our investment. By averaging in, we take the guesswork and the emotion out of investing. We get out of the business of market timing. And many of us already dollar cost average every month as 401k investors. Of course, Stephen here is preaching to the choir when he suggests that the investment of choice is an index fund, which provides broad equity exposure and, of course, at a very low cost. I have saved Mr. Yoder's article and intend to teach these lessons, hopefully, to my own future grandchildren. Now, each semester, in my finance class, I provide a reading list to my students. And really at the top of that list is a book entitled The Millionaire Next Door. It's an old book. The authors are William Danko and Thomas Stanley. The publisher is Simon & Schuster. The book is a wonderful read, and it contains a rather simple thesis. Most millionaires achieve millionaire status by spending less than they earn. They spend less than they earn. Remember, it's never how much you earn. It's great to earn a lot, but it's really how much you spend. What percentage of what you earn do you indeed spend? In other words, these folks live below their means. They understand the difference between wants and needs. They are typically unpretentious in terms of lifestyle. They may live next door to you. And they are disciplined savers and live the financial philosophy articulated by Mr. Yoder in his Wall Street Journal piece. All right. Each month, we re-examine our couch potato portfolio, which, as you know, consists of 8 Vanguard stock indexes, or what we call passive asset classes. Remember that this portfolio is simply an asset allocation model for investing funds if you want to invest in a stock portfolio. Obviously, all of us need a portion of our assets in savings, in money markets, in short-term fixed income for those emergency purposes or for purposes of further diversification or even acting as a hedge to our stock portfolio. Now, our 8 stock indexes, as you know, cover the gamut from the big companies to the small companies, from the glamour companies to the value and out-of-favor companies, from U.S. companies to Japanese companies to European companies, even to the emerging markets. Now, through last night's close, our portfolio year-to-date is a positive 11.45%. We always compare our portfolio return to our benchmark, and of course our benchmark is the S&P 500, which is ahead about 9% for the year. So once again, this year diversification is paying off as the spread between our portfolio and the benchmark is approximately a positive 2.3%. Now you can access the portfolio on the WILL website. I believe, Dave, you click on what, Focus 580, mm-hmm. and then click on Couch Potato Portfolio, mm-hmm. and that should bring up the portfolio, and it is current through last night's close. So there you have it, David. I'd be happy to answer questions about issues I've raised or tackle the questions on the minds of our listeners. And one other particular concept and one other economic area I think we ought to cover, especially if our listeners are interested in it, are these issues of inflation. And it's a real funny business. We just heard not 5 minutes ago Ben Bernanke basically saying and basically defending QE2, this business of going in and buying somewhere between $600 and $800 billion of treasuries, basically with printed money, and then putting those treasuries on the Fed's balance sheet. The theory being that we're going to take these treasuries out of circulation, and when we take them out, we're going to bid them up so the price becomes more expensive, and when price gets higher, interest rates tend to go down. So the theory is that because the Fed funds rate, the interest rates that banks borrow money overnight is already so bloody low, about 15 basis points, maybe a quarter of a percent, the Fed doesn't have that kind of ammunition to, in that manner, lower interest rates. So let's lower them another way by taking these treasuries out of circulation, increasing the money supply, putting more money in the hands of individuals and institutions. And my goodness, what in the world are you going to do with that money? Well, are you going to buy more fixed income instruments? The hope, of course, is that business is going to borrow money. Business is going to make investments. And the notion is that the best place to make investments is in people. And we're going to hire more people. And as a result, unemployment may trickle down. I think that's the basic concept. That's the basic theory that the Federal Reserve and Mr. Bernanke are currently operating on. A lot of folks are concerned, hey, when you simply print more money, whether it's a dollar or whether it's $600 billion, that's some serious money, and we don't have additional productivity in our economy, doesn't that lead to inflation? And yesterday there was a lead article in the Wall Street Journal talking about inflation. And interestingly enough, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics produces that monthly rate and says, hey, over the last 12 months, inflation has only been about 1%, all of us are scratching our heads. We're saying, wait a second. I think gasoline is a whole lot more expensive than it was a year ago. Indeed, it is. And I know that anybody who's been to the grocery store at a restaurant is spending a heck of a lot more money. How is it possible that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is suggesting that inflation overall is only up about 1% from a year ago? And here's the bottom line. When the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates that retail CPI inflationary rate, over one-third of that calculation is based on housing prices, rental prices, and how interest rates impact housing prices. And that basically is dead in the water. And in many cases, with housing values still decreasing, it actually creates a negative bias, if you will. So even though gasoline is up, food is up, clothing is down, housing is down, the net impact is what appears to be a fairly tame inflation rate. But at the same time, when we look at the cost of a college education, tuition and fees, when we look at medical costs, when we look at housing, food, it affects everyone differently. And that's the key thing to keep in mind. Inflation impacts all of us differently, yet our own government, our Bureau of Labor Statistics, can tell us overall that the inflation rate, if we take all these basket of goods and services, why it's only up about 1% from a year ago, October. So that's a little bit of analysis on inflation, and I hope that clears it up for our listeners.
All right. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller in Spring Bay. We'll go right there, and it's line four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I've been listening to this show for a long time, and I've got a little different thinking these days, I suppose. I'd like to throw some of it out and let David respond to it. I hesitate to invest in the stock market these days because I think the thing is just so unstable. The tax situation with our big deficits, QE2, the Bush tax breaks, now, the top 2%, what are they going to be taxed? I really think that they need to pay more tax. The quantitative easing, it seems to me that a lot of this money has gone into foreign bonds, that we've been loaning it out at 0% interest, and people have been taking this money and sending it over to foreign governments where they get a higher interest rate. I think that's problematic. And then the continued lack of aggressive litigation on the bank fraud that has happened here in this country in the last few years with the mortgage situation. It seems to me that the whole system is in need of a lot of overhaul and a lot of reform and increased regulation. And until I start to see those things happening, I'm very hesitant to invest in the stock market. So I'll hang up and listen to your response and enjoy your program. Thank you.
Well, those are all great aspects of issues facing the good old U.S. of A. And indeed, they're not only U.S. problems, they are indeed global problems. Unquestionably, it remains to be seen whether federal easing this additional amount of money in QE2 is going to be utilized to make foreign investments. That is a fear. It's been raised by a number of people. So kudos to our listener who raised that issue. And interestingly enough, you raised the issue of bank fraud and litigation. We saw just this week that the FDIC is finally announcing that they are going after a number of senior officers and even members of board of directors. I believe the litigation now encompasses over 100 financial institutions, and many, many more are going to be involved in this. So it remains to be seen what kinds of monies can be recovered, if any. It's going to be tough to prove a negligence case after the fact when an awful lot of people didn't realize the risk that they were taking. So you're right. It's always tough. There are always difficult issues and difficult problems. But, you know, I'm sort of a perennial optimist. I have to be. I like to be optimistic, and I take a very, very long-term view of stock markets in general. I'm what's referred to as a legacy investor. So I'm looking at 30 and 35-year consecutive periods in stock market history. And again, when you take that very long-term view and you continue to dollar cost average in, you can't find a period of time where you really would have been better off in any other alternative kinds of investments. If you think inflation is going to be a big issue down the road, historically, stocks have been one of the safe havens, a diversified portfolio, that is, to sort of keep up with inflation. And remember, stock market investing is counterintuitive. Usually people do best when things look worst. It's just very important because what's happening is that you are able to buy shares of stock at lower prices. And winning in the stock market is a share accumulation game, not a price accumulation game. Because when prices are lower and things look bad, then you can purchase more. All right, so what if the stock market takes a 10% dip, even a 15% dip from here? If you are continuing to average into the market, you are going to be buying new shares at lower and lower prices. So you're going to be averaging out. But historically, while there are dips and while there are nasty corrections over long, long periods of time, the direction of stocks has been positive. So that would be my reaction. I know the caller has just raised all kinds of great issues.
All right. Well, we'll go on. We have several other people. Next is someone who is listening in Morton Grove, and they're on line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. Good morning, Dr. Sino.
Good morning.
My question is this here. What investments are appropriate for someone in retirement whose main concern is income and preservation of capital? What might investments look like for a person who has the main focus on that?
Well, you probably would be looking, first of all, at an asset allocation model. And when we look at an asset allocation model, preservation of capital really also has to take into consideration preservation of the worth of your dollar given inflation. So that tells me that over long periods of time, you need still to have some exposure to a broadly diversified portfolio of equities. And I would urge, in fact, most of my clients have somewhere between 30 and 50% of their overall portfolio in equities. And these are retired folks, because over long periods of time, I am very concerned about inflation. Having said that, so for example, 30 to 40, 50% could be in something like a portfolio that is followed on the WILL website. With the remaining 40, 50, even 60% or more, that should be devoted to some very short-term emergency money that you can grasp very, very quickly. It's very liquid, and if you have an emergency, it's just like cash. And then I would be looking at money markets and short-term fixed income with maturities no greater in this market of certainly 2 to 4 years, because I think ultimately we're going to see interest rates go up, so we're going to see fixed income instruments go down. Bonds have had a very nice run, and I think that run is pretty well over. So another strategy with your fixed income might be simply a ladder, where you're taking 10% of your fixed income and buying a one-year instrument, 10% in a two-year instrument, 10% in a three-year instrument. Also, I would caution people in retirement who are purchasing municipal bonds. I think there is a tremendous amount of risk today in municipal bonds. So be very, very careful, even in the case of purchasing what are called general obligation municipal bonds. I think it's very possible, unless the Fed, unless we as a government start bailing out certain cities, certain agencies, certain states, there is a substantial risk of default with respect to municipal bonds. So again, at least 30 to 40% in stocks, 60, maybe 50% in fixed income, slightly more, and stay on the short term. The problem, of course, is that when we are looking at short-term fixed income investments, the interest rates of return, well, they're just paltry. They're just paltry. And all I can say is stay patient, stay patient, stay patient. So that's my response.
And annuities, Doctor, any of those, and I realize there are varieties of them available.
There are.
Any of interest that might fit a profile as I describe myself?
Well, two potential ideas. One is called an immediate annuity. That is where you hand a specific amount of money to the insurance company, and the insurance company immediately starts paying you a monthly rate of return. It's very easy to figure out what the amortized interest rate is. In addition, there is something called a variable or an inflationary adjusted immediate annuity. In other words, it starts when you hand that money to the insurance company. It starts at a lower monthly rate of return than just a fixed annuity, but it adjusts for inflation. Those are quite popular. And finally, if you are charitably minded, probably the best game in town is what is called a charitable annuity. And that is where you hand a sum of money to a charity of your choice, and they pay you an annuitized benefit monthly. And the rate that those charitable annuities are based on are basically published by the American Gift Annuity Association, and those rates are typically higher rates than the rates that you would receive from an insurance company. Plus, you get a partial tax deduction for giving that money to the charity. But so long as you are living, you get a monthly payment back. So those are all possibilities.
Well, that's wonderful, Doctor, many of which I would have not come to on my own. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. We're about midway through this first hour of Focus. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. Once a month, he stops by here. It's on a Friday, and we talk about personal finance and money management. So if you have a particular question about your own investing strategies, this can be one piece in the puzzle of your figuring out what you're going to do. Call us. May I ask a question? Dave will give you his thoughts. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Normal is next, line two. Hello.
Oh, hey, hello. Excellent program. Hey, yeah, I like that. What you're saying with the average cost purchasing, you can take advantage of decline in prices because you'll be able to purchase a little bit more than what you had at an earlier time when the prices were higher, so you can take advantage and acquire a larger. I do. I like that.
Exactly.
I wanted to verify some information I heard to see if you could verify if it's a myth or urban legend, but that so with quantitative easing, the Fed is actually purchasing the treasuries from holdings that Goldman Sachs is sitting on, and that they're not going to the Bureau of Debt or whatever it is. They're actually going to Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is like, hey, we got a bunch of treasury bonds. Why don't you buy them off of us? And that the purchaser of this is conducted through the New York branch of the Federal Reserve, and that the person in charge of this activity was once an agent of some form or another of this Goldman Sachs. I wonder if that was true or what. And then I wonder about the possibility of QE3 or QE4, that maybe if foreigners stop purchasing bonds on the markets, they have no recourse but to quantitative ease. But we should remember it's quantitative, not qualitative. And the 1%, that's only because they say, well, instead of eating steak, we'll go for hot dogs. I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Right. Well, first of all, Goldman Sachs is one of the primary dealers in treasuries. How many treasuries are being purchased from Goldman Sachs? I certainly don't know. It isn't a reported number. I'm sure it's proprietary at Goldman Sachs. But it would surprise me greatly if Goldman Sachs is the only primary dealer who is involved in this purchase of treasuries for the Fed. With respect to other issues that were raised, QE3, QE4, it remains to be seen. But again, we have to remember, where are other countries going to put their money? Where are they really going to put their money? There are problems everywhere. And again, when people face global problems, they look for stability of regime. And I think we can't underestimate regime stability in the United States. Whether we like our leaders, whether we hate our leaders, it doesn't matter. We all subscribe to an orderly process of electing our leaders. We are clearly the most stable regime in the world. We are the envy of the world in that sense. And as a result, that gives our currency amazing stability and amazing interest among other countries. As you can see, just over the last several weeks, how our currency is actually appreciated. It's interesting. We've actually appreciated over many of the other currencies despite our problems. So I'm not terribly worried about that, certainly in the short run.
It seems to be the case, and no matter how bad things are right now, that also seems to be the case that foreign investors look at the United States and they believe in its long-term potential. That is that over time things are going to get better and the economy is going to continue to be strong, and that the hope is that things are going to turn around and we're going to have an upturn.
I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, David.
Line three, Champagne. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. One of the options that a holder of a 403B has is to convert it into an IRA.
Correct.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of making that conversion?
Well, if we convert to an IRA, remember that that would be a tax-deferred conversion. And you would make that conversion after you retire. If you are an active employee continuing to participate in a 403B, that option is not available. So I presume that this is a case of retirement.
Right.
All right. So if you convert to your self-directed IRA, then it perhaps provides you a menu of choices, a menu of opportunities that are not available to you through your 403B. Because in a 403B, you are given a finite number of choices from which to choose. By moving to an IRA, perhaps at a major brokerage firm, call it a Schwab, call it a Fidelity, call it an Ameritrade, whatever, you then have carte blanche access to the world of securities. So that comes with some responsibility, because sometimes what happens is people move to their own self-directed IRA and then they get all involved in trading and buying and selling, and that can certainly be counterproductive, right? Now, the minimum distribution rules are basically the same. So the year in which you reach 70 and a half, then you are really going to take about 1/27th of the previous year-end balance out of your 403B or your IRA, and then you're going to have to pay income tax on it. So if you are happy in your 403B, you love the choices, you love how it's being managed, then there is no requirement that you move out of that 403B.
Okay, so the two things that you mentioned, I'll say that required the minimum distribution, as you say, is the same. And the advantage of moving to an IRA is if you choose a self-directed IRA, then, of course, you can self-direct what the investments are.
Absolutely.
And that's the beginning and the end of the advantages and disadvantages?
Well, I think one other advantage of a self-directed IRA is remember that you have the ability now to move money to a Roth IRA. And if you have, let's say you had $50,000 in a self-directed IRA, and you were thinking of moving it to a Roth IRA, Well, one thing that you could do is you say, you know, I don't have to move all of it. I could move $10,000 of it a year into a Roth IRA and only pay tax on $10,000 to make certain that I don't move above my current tax bracket.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a little bit more flexibility in playing with the money if you were considering moving from self-directed traditional IRA to a self-directed Roth.
I see. Okay. And if a person is perfectly happy with their 403B as it is, there's no particular reason to move?
Not particularly.
Okay. Are all these things also true of the 457s?
Yeah. Generally, yes. 457, there are less choices typically.
Uh-huh. Okay. But the minimum distribution things are the same, and the advantages are...
Pretty much the same.
The same.
Pretty much the same.
So there are no other differences.
Well, there probably are, but those are the ones that come to the top of my head at this very moment.
Well, okay, yeah, no big things.
No.
All right. Thank you very kindly, Ezra.
Thank you. We'll go to line one. This is Champagne. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
I think you sort of touched on this a moment ago, but what would be the implication on stocks and bonds if, say, California defaults on its bonds, and then maybe Illinois defaults on its bonds? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, it would put bondholders, number one, in a world of hurt if our federal government did not have a huge bailout. Remember, as part of TARP and a lot of the money that was processed over the last couple of years, it found its way into state coffers. And as a result, it reduced budget deficits in many states. So number one, if we actually had a bond issue or a state default, it would have enormous impact. California is one of the five or six largest economies in the world. So it would be like one of the largest countries of the world defaulting. It would clearly have enormous consequences. And then if the federal government didn't bail them out, didn't loan them the money, if you will, so bondholders could be made whole, it would create probably a spillover effect into many other states and municipalities. I wouldn't look forward to that at all. What I'm saying simply is that that is possible, that we could see certain municipal bonds default. So it's very important if you are a holder of individual municipal bonds, you probably bought those through some type of broker. Maybe you bought them yourself online. You need to talk to a financial advisor or at least investigate what is backing those particular bonds, because some bonds can default, others maybe next door don't. It depends on what is backing, what kinds of taxing authority is backing those particular bonds. But unquestionably, it would not be a happy day. And it would, of course, have a very, very profound and certainly a major impact on all of us as investors.
I have an email here I want to get in from someone who writes, I'm a postal worker who has $200,000 in the Thrift Savings Program. He says, I'm planning on retiring in 7 years at the age of 66. I now have 80% of my shares in the most conservative L fund, which is designed for people who are already retired. I'm planning on moving 10% per month into the 2020 fund, which is for people who are planning on retiring between 2015 and 2025. Is this a sound strategy?
Well, that's something I don't know a great deal about, David. I'm going to assume for a moment that this particular postal worker, in addition to having his or her own thrift savings, is also going to have a pension from the federal government. That's probably pretty clear. So this is sort of like 403B money, 457 money, 401K money. In other words, this is additional money that has been saved out of an employee's paycheck in addition to the pension that one will expect. And if anyone in this country is going to get a pension, it's going to be a federal worker, because we can always print the money. We're not sure what it's worth, but we can always print the money to pay that pensioner when he or she retires from the federal government. That's not the case in particular states, as we know. So therefore, if you are a very conservative person, I want you to think of a pension as sort of fixed income. In other words, every month you've got this big engine of fixed income sitting out here, and you are able to draw from that this pension amount. So I would be cautious to put all of your eggs in additional fixed income. I'm not familiar with what is comprised in the L funds or the 2020 funds, but I'm a little bit concerned that you don't have some equity exposure. Because if we took a present value analysis of that, those pension payments that you're going to expect 5 or 7 years down the road, that's an enormous number. That's a bigger number than the $200,000 sitting in your thrift plan. So as a result, I am guessing, I'm just guessing and surmising, that 80 to 90% of your current net worth, including the present value of that future pension benefit, is probably fixed income. So you might be well underweighted in your equity exposure. So that's all I'm going to say about it because, again, I'm not familiar with what is comprised, what is composed in the L funds and the 2020 funds, but you need to have some equity exposure. Mm-hmm. And how much you want is up to you.
And do you, now, the various people have various kinds of rules of thumb, essentially, I think, based on age, or maybe also you have to figure in when you think you're going to retire. And then you also really should have some idea about what your expenses are going to be, and then you kind of have to know how long you plan on living and some things like that.
Yeah, but those are sort of things that you got to worry about.
But generally speaking, is there a rule of thumb that you like to use for asset allocation?
Well, a lot of people think the following. Take 100, subtract your age of 65, I ought to have 35% of my money in equities. That's sort of a starting place. Then we have to do some type of sensitivity analysis and examine your individual situation. But for a typical person who is retired at 65, I think it's prudent to have at least 30 to 35% in a diversified portfolio of equities.
All right. On to another caller, and this is someone who is in Mahomet, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have one comment and then one question. And the comment is that I enjoy shows like this from the perspective of investing, that is, where to put your money for maximum growth and long-term yield. But the question that oftentimes gets overlooked is that when you're ready to start spending, what are good guidelines on spending what you have, and have those guidelines changed over the years? So you might want to. I'd like to hear what you have to say about responsible spending from retirement accounts. So that's the comment. The question that I have is a little bit more direct, and that is that I took advantage of the VRP here at the University of Illinois, and so come retirement time, there will be two large distributions that come to me that are retirement eligible, and so they can be rolled into IRAs or through the university. And I've given some thought to this, and I thought maybe since this is it's a good chunk of change, but it's not critical to our lifestyle, I thought that what I might do is just pick a couple of broad-based funds, one a broad-based maybe equity mutual fund and the other one a broad-based bond fund through Fidelity. And I wonder what you thought about that kind of an idea, maybe a 60-40 or a 50-50 distribution of those. So I'm going to hang up and allow you to...
Hang on just 1 second.
Okay.
So in other words, this additional money is separate from your pension.
It's separate from the pension. That's
okay.
Correct. So this is the overpayment into CSRS.
Exactly.
Also the sick leave.
Okay. Good.
Accumulated sick leave. So that's what those two chunks of money are.
Okay. I don't have any difficulty with your taking that money and utilizing it in an asset allocation model of 50-50 or 60-40 at retirement. None whatsoever. I think that in terms of equity exposure, you probably would be better off with 3 or 4 indexes as opposed to simply one. And again, with respect to the fixed income, I would probably have some in very short term, maybe a short term corporate at Fidelity, and maybe a midterm treasury corporate bond fund mix at Fidelity. They have a number of bond funds that you could choose from. But in terms of an overall asset allocation mix, not a problem. But I would have at least 40% exposure in the stock market, perhaps as much as 50%. You've raised a wonderful question, and that is, okay, I'm now retired. I have an asset allocation model. What can I reasonably afford to spend or distribute out of my 401ks, my 403bs, my IRAs, or my other savings? And here's what I suggest. It's a much smaller number than most people think, because we have to look at life expectancy and indeed joint life expectancy. And if you retire in your 60s and you are married, one of you is likely to live to 90 or perhaps even longer. So we've got to make certain that money lasts over a substantial period of time. Now, in the case of this particular caller, assuming that the state of Illinois is going to make good on its pension, the pension amount goes up by 3% annually. So you've got a great inflation hedge. But let's say that you don't have that. Let's say that you have saved. You've been a great saver. You've lived below your wants. You've just always each month dollar cost average. And now I have this bucket of money. How much can I take out of it? Well, there have been lots and lots of academic studies done, tremendous numbers of computer simulations done. And here's what they find for a married couple retiring in their 60s. They find that if you have an asset allocation of about 40% equities and 60% fixed income, you can afford to take out first year approximately 3.5% of that principal balance. If it's $1 million, that's $35,000. And then each year thereafter, you can adjust that number by inflation. So if inflation is 2%, then the next year I could take 102% or 1.02% of my $35,000, which would take me up to about $35,700. And of course, the money continues to be invested. If you follow that type of scenario, where you probably have around 40% equity, 60% fixed income, maybe a 50-50 portfolio, there's a 99% certainty that you're not going to run out of money before you run out of life. But the notion of taking out 7, 8, 9, 10% on an annual basis, there is a strong probability that you are going to run out of money before you run out of life. Also, timing does make some difference when you retire. What you hope happens when you retire is that the markets are actually moving up, as opposed to the markets taking a big hit, because it makes a huge difference in retirement how much money you take out in early years. You take out less money in early years if your stock market portfolio is moving south. It's moving down. So again, you would have to adjust that original 3.5% number to a lesser number if it happens that you retired, for example, in 2008 and you hit the debacle of 2008 and 2009. You can't take 3.5% out of that portfolio. You'd have to take substantially less. When times are better, the market has recovered, your portfolio has recovered, then you can start thinking about taking more money out of the portfolio. But as a general rule, 3.5% when you start, when you retire, and then adjust it each year for inflation.
I hope that helps the caller. We have about 5 or 6 minutes in this part of Focus with David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign, once a month, always on a Friday. He's here and we talk about money management. So if there's someone out there, one or two people maybe, if you want to call real quick, we can accommodate you in the time that remains. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu.
Something else I wanted to bring up very, very quickly before we get back to the phone lines. For younger people with children, I want to talk very quickly about term life insurance. Term life insurance is at an all-time low cost. It's a very, very soft underwriting market. And it's a great time to think about purchasing term life insurance. You can purchase it year to year and renew it, or you can purchase it for a term of years. So 15-year level term, 20-year level term is very, very inexpensive. And I would urge our listeners to talk to their children if they are married with kids to make certain that they are adequately insured. Term life insurance is very, very inexpensive.
Okay. And just to make sure that everybody understands, what I'm assuming that we were talking about here is this is not the kind of insurance that has an investment component. This is just the kind that pays a benefit in the case that you or your partner or both should die. It's there so that there's money to go and take care of your kids.
Exactly. We're not talking about universal life insurance. We're not talking about ordinary whole life, cash value life. We're talking about a standard vanilla product called term life insurance.
Right. Well, now we have several callers, and we may not be able to get everybody, but we'll try. Starting with Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes, I talked to you a little bit before about converting from 403B to IRA, and your mention of required minimum distribution made me think that one of the advantages, I believe, of converting from a 403B or a 457 to an IRA is that then when at required minimum distribution time, one can take out of any of the IRAs that one wants all that's required for the required minimum distribution over all of the accounts. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. So the follow-up question is there anything specific that one gives up or loses by converting from a 403B to an IRA or a 457 to an IRA?
Well, in some cases in a 403B, if you are employed after the age of 70 and a half, depending upon whether the 403B program was grandfathered in, you may not have to take a minimum distribution. But by 75, you must take a minimum distribution. That is a question for the benefits officer in the 403B program that you are enrolled in.
Okay.
So under certain circumstances, you can put off taking a 403B distribution.
Okay. Any other disadvantages of giving up a 403B or a 457?
Not that I can think of at the moment.
All right. Thank you kindly.
All right. Line two is Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Just a quick question. What do you think of tips in the current environment?
I frankly think tips in any environment are good, and I think they make up a small portion of a fixed income portfolio. So I have no problem if you have a dollar in a fixed income portfolio, the 10 to 15 cents of that dollar is in tips.
All right. And better define that for us.
Well, a tip is basically a Treasury inflation protected security.
Ah, okay.
In other words, its value moves with inflation.
All right. To line number three, and this is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question. I'm going to have some 1031 money coming in, or some money that would be available to put into a 1031 exchange.
Yes.
And I'm wondering about would it be prudent to buy farm ground for the next, say, 10, 15 years of investing? Time frame. I don't need the money now, and I won't need it for the next 10 years.
Okay, a couple of things. Now, you're talking about 1031 money, so I presume you have a segregated trust set up to accept that 1031 money. It's not coming directly to you. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so you've got your Starker exchange or your like-kind exchange properly set up. Number two, you have, from the time that you receive that money, you've got 90 days to find that property and tell your trustee, hey, I have located and identified the property, and you have 180 days, not 181, but 180 days to close on that property from the day that you received your money in the 1031 exchange. So have you already identified the farmland?
No, I have not.
Okay. So remember, don't violate those rules or otherwise the capital gains are all going to be subject to tax. As far as investing in farmland long term, I think it's a great investment.
Okay. Thank you much.
All right. Very good. On to the next caller. Someone in Moultrie County. Line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Trying to make this quick. I've been using spreadsheets. As we always talk on Social Security withdrawal to wait as long as possible. But I've been noticing there seems to be some tax advantages in that Social Security is basically taxed about half, depending on what conditions you put in. Have you looked at that angle of withdrawing Social Security?
Well, the amount that you are taxed in Social Security, for some people, they are not taxed at all, depending upon their income. But if you are married, are you married, sir?
No, sir.
Okay. For a single taxpayer, as I recall the rule, once you're above $25,000 of income other than Social Security income, then the majority of that Social Security is going to be subject to tax at your highest marginal bracket. In fact, 85% of what you would receive from Social Security will be subject to tax. So here's the bottom line. Let's say you have a $50,000 income outside of Social Security. You get $10,000 of Social Security. 85% of $10,000 is $8,500. You would add that $8,500 to your other income, and it would be taxed at your highest marginal rate.
Okay.
So figure that 85% of whatever you receive from Social Security, you're just going to add that amount to your other income and then figure the taxes. That's an easy way to think of it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yes.
Right, very good. Let's go to line one, Clinton. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I have some parents at home. They're about age 90. All their money was in certificates, which now it went below 1%. So they advised to put it in money market. They're only making 1% on this, and all they have is Social Security and that. Someone advised me of maybe putting that in Vanguard intermediate term tax-exempt bond funds because it's making 3.8. Is that a good idea or not? Because you just mentioned something about staying away from municipal bonds.
Well, again, Vanguard intermediate gives you diversification, but the bottom line is that if interest rates start to trend up, the principal value of that bond fund will trend down. So as far as part of an overall income portfolio, I don't have a problem with it, 10, maybe 15% in an investment like that, but surely not all of it. Unfortunately, your patience is going to have to continue to be exercised because there just aren't good alternatives for people in their 90s,
right,
if you will.
Don't, they don't have a whole lot of time.
Yeah, they don't have a whole lot of time, so you're not going to take a whole lot of risk. You've got to have emergency money on hand, et cetera. So a little bit in that fund wouldn't bother me.
Other than that, you have nowhere else to go.
It's very, very tough when you're looking at one-year CD rates at 1%, basically.
Right.
That's where you are.
I'm making that at money market.
All right, so stick in the money market.
Okay.
All right. Well, there we will finish up with this time around. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I once a month. On Friday, he's here. We do these shows to try to help you out with money management.
Thank you, David. Lots of great questions.
Yeah. All right. And Dave will be back again next month.